You've tuned in to the Community Character Hour. We begin each episode with a newspaper clipping from the past. And what have we got today, Hannah?
This is from the Pondere Review on January 26th, 1933. There is every indication that the crowds from Spokane, Sandpoint, Bonner's Ferry, and other inland empire towns now planning to attend the second international ski meet at Kingsgate Eastport on February 5th will be double or three times as large as last year, according to dispatches from Bonner's Ferry. Many of the best ski jumpers of the Northwest have signified their intention of attending the Kingsgate Eastport tournament. The hill at Eastport is in the finest condition and will permit much longer jumps than did the hill at the Spokane ski jumping contest last Sunday. So this is such a cool thing. Established in 1928, the Eastport Kingsgate ski jump had a unique feature. It was located exactly on the border of two countries. The in-run was in the United States, and the landing hill was in Canada. The facility was looked after by the cross-border ski club, Kingsgate Eastport Ski Club, operating in close communities of border towns. In 1932 and 1933, there were tournaments on the hill, and in the second one, the best distance was 177 feet. The ski jump stopped functioning around 1940.
Wow. This was, okay, ski jumping in the 30s already and established in the 20s.
Yeah.
This is, I guess I don't know my history of winter sport very well.
There is, thankfully, a wonderful, I believe, Swiss website that inventories all of the ski jump hills around the world. And this is but one of many, but ski jumping was very big in the 20s and 30s, which is where you would just have one big hill, and then there would be a built-up ramp, typically made of snow, at the bottom, and you would see how far you could, you would just go barreling straight down the hill and see how far you could launch off of this ramp. But with this one, you would go down the hill in Idaho and go, and you would land in Canada, which is just something I don't think you could get away with today, but I love that they were doing it back then.
It certainly takes cross-country skiing to a whole new level. Sorry, I just had to.
Yes. Well, that is crazy. The X Games didn't even start till like the 90s. What were they doing in the 20s? This wasn't even televised.
Yeah.
Just doing it for fun.
Yeah.
And this was before Sun Valley Ski Resort even was fully opened.
Cool.
Back in the day when you could get the permission slip from your parents to go over the border.
Yeah.
Well, here we are. My name's Jack Peterson, and I'm joined, as always, by Hannah Combs, Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and Heather Upton, who is the Arts and Historic Preservation Planner for the City of Sandpoint. And what are we talking about today, Heather?
Well, we're going to tie up the end of the year with a nice, like, beautiful bow. And can you guess how we're going to tie that all up? With what subject?
Well, I think we did a pretty obvious lead-in. Yeah.
Okay, we're talking about
Schweitzer.
Yes, that name has a lot of history behind it, for sure.
I think the most prevalent history that I hear all the time has to do with, like, womanizing and cats.
Behind the name itself of the mountain. Yeah, okay.
And where that came from?
Where did that come from?
Indeed.
Well, you're not entirely wrong about those two aspects. The story starts over 50 years before the ski resort was even a twinkle in the eye of its creators. On a summer morning in 1893, while riding her filly, Nellie, to work, Ella Mae Farman, of course, she comes into every story, first encountered a strange individual dressed in some sort of well-worn military uniform, standing trailside at strict attention, musket at his side as she passed. This went on for a few days until one morning, he instead stepped out onto the trail and, taking Nellie by the reins, led the pony about a half a mile along the path before letting go and disappearing back into the woods. When Ella Mae told her husband, L.D., and her son, Earl, about this strange occurrence, young Earl said, that it sounded a lot like a friendly old hermit named Schweitzer, who lived alone in a small cabin near where he and his friend Harry Nesbitt liked to fish. This took the edge off of Ella May's concern, but she started cantering Nellie through that section of woods anyway.
So then this continued. So then, not long after, the man showed up at the railroad station during Ella May's shift. Speaking in a thick Swiss accent, he informed her that he had come to seek her advice regarding his intention to kill a local settler and take the settler's wife as his own. Ella May made an eloquent argument intending to dissuade the man from his plan, and after he had left, sent a warning to the settler that he was the target of a murder plot. The next morning, Schweitzer came back to the station to tell Ella May that he had decided to take her advice and not follow through on his plan, and that because Ella May was both younger and prettier than his other intended bride, it was his intention to carry her off. Instead, and I just like imagined her like picking her up and like throwing him over his shoulder. Unarmed and alone at this little station and not a soul in earshot, Ella May decided to put on a front, a bravado. So standing up, she began loudly berating the man. Schweitzer, you know I have a husband of my own and I'm a respectable woman and you cannot talk to me as you are doing, she exclaimed. Let me tell you, my husband and the railroad company will fix you if you carry me off. She stood there silently for what seemed an eternity. Then tipping his hat to her, he politely answered, well, for the present, we will drop the matter.
Okay, this is quite a character. How do we know the details of this story?
Well, this story came straight from Ella May Farman's memoir, The Days of a Woman.
Okay.
We have a copy of it at the museum, so we do reference this quite a bit. This is where a lot of the stories of the early pre-newspaper days of Sandpoint come from, because she was one of the best chroniclers of everyday happenings in town.
There was I was reading a book, and the details of that were a little different. Like it seemed like, or in the Jack Fowler's The History of Schweitzer, he seems to indicate that the early days, seems to think that he was just trying to help her to the station or something on a snowy night. He was just trying to be helpful.
But, if only we had his memoir.
I know. Yeah.
Right.
We don't, but he was
the other side.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're all sides of the story.
I don't know. But anyway, but Ella May writes the story.
Yeah.
Okay.
So as she tells it, from that day forward, she kept a six-gun alongside her Bible in the drawer next to the telegraph machine at work. And LD immediately contacted the nearest railway agent at the Spokane office, who, accompanied by the county sheriff and a doctor from Rathdrum, arrived the following day to look into the affair. Upon entering the recluse's cabin, located near where Bronx Road now crosses Schweitzer Creek, they found the hides of numerous cats nailed to the walls, and a pot full of cats boiling on the stove for the man's supper, thereby solving the mystery of the recent disappearances of numerous of the town's pets.
Okay.
Schweitzer was taken into custody, remanded to what they called the county farm for observation, and he was later committed to an insane asylum where, as Ella May put it, he lived out the rest of his life a dangerous and raving lunatic. Although I kind of doubt she probably visited him at the asylum. And to this day, Earl and Harry's favorite fishing spot has been known as Schweitzer Creek and the mountain above, Schweitzer Mountain.
I mean, I've heard that the ski resort has thought about changing the name a few times, but why would, with an origin story like that, why would you?
Right.
Exactly.
I bet it is like good as, you know, a ski resort to have a little bit of lore behind the name.
And I think over the years it will probably continue to metamorphosize.
I bet like if there are any employees of Schweitzer listening in, that the people of Schweitzer have their own additional stories they could add.
It'd be amazing to track down his family if they claim him.
Right.
Well, he was a hermit. He lived alone.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't have any. He remains a mystery. So the origins of the ski slope itself was less disturbing, but full of twists and turns, with a dash of suspense and a happy ending. The story starts in April of 1960 when Jack Fowler, a Spokane dentist, and his family were driving back from a rainy ski trip to Big Mountain in Montana, just east of Hope, along Highway 200. They stopped to stretch their legs. While taking in this amazing view, Jack saw what had eluded them that trip: snow. It was cradled in a protective bowl, which had preserved it in the change of the season. And in that moment, an idea was born.
Jack said in his book about Schweitzer, "Each component of the view was aesthetically satisfying. The lake, the dotted islands, the expanse of forest, the greening grass, which announced spring, and in the distance to the west, snow in all of its shimmering splendor."
The place was already known as Schweitzer Basin to locals, for whom the idea of skiing the basin was not new. James Brown Jr. and his friends had skied the area as early as 1930s. Jim Brown grew up skiing on the ski team at Mount Spokane.
And this is the Pack River Lumber Company Browns, that same Brown family?
Yeah.
Okay.
And their family owned a lot of property in the vicinity of Schweitzer Basin from their logging operations.
So this is where it gets really fun when you start having these community character individuals keep reappearing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Weaving kind of the needle together of our stories. So you all remember Jim Parsons from our last episode on the K&K Derby, right?
Yes, of course. He was a war correspondent who came back and was, instrumental in starting the K&K Derby.
And yet again, we're mm-hmm. getting that note of tourism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Jim Parsons Jr.'s family, Jim Parsons Jr. was hugely involved in this effort. So the son of Jim Parsons, he was really big in helping support and build Schweitzer. And he's really known as a photographer for all of his early Schweitzer photographs, which is amazing mm-hmm. that we had someone documenting the evolution of that ski mountain.
And we're really lucky that Jim Parsons Jr.'s family recently donated Clarice and Jim Parsons Jr.'s photographic collection to the museum.
So incredible. And doesn't that collection go all the way back to the 1930s with his grandfather, John Page?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And okay, so those are the photos at City Hall.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah, you have some great ones at City Hall. Those, I would say, are some of the jewels of the collection because Jim picked those out himself.
Oh, he was amazing.
But we estimate that there are probably about 30,000 images in total, which we've just begun to catalog.
Oh,
and those are going to span his entire career and, like you said, that of his grandfather, John Page.
That's so incredible. So you're looking for volunteers?
Yes, please.
Okay, stay tuned for more information about that.
So Jim had met Fowler and Grosbeck skiing at Mount Spokane, and he was eager to scout Schweitzer's potential with them. He said sometimes they would snowshoe in, and that was about 9 miles, or they would hitch a ride on Bob Cox's yellow snowcat, fondly referred to as Old Yellow. Yeller.
Mm-hmm. Like the dog.
I feel like I need a little accent with that one.
Yeah.
Jim would take a lot of photos for reference, and he said it was always fun because you got to ski your way back out.
Oh, that would be super fun.
Wow.
So they started going in there and mm-hmm. and amazing. Checking things out and doing all this research. But, I mean, what did they do next? Who do they have to convince to make this thing into a ski resort rather than just a vacant bowl in the mountains?
Yeah. So Fowler was going to have to convince the entire community, but he didn't think it would be too hard. Most adventurous locals already saw the potential of the basin for skiing, But at that time, it was too hard to just access on a casual weekend. The, you know, the 9 mile
right,
hike,
9 mile snowshoe, exactly, and ride on Old Yeller. Yeah.
So Fowler just had to find a way to make the experience less of an expedition. So with Grant Grosbeck, who was a fellow optimist and friend, he decided to do just that. Their original dream included buying some land, which they did in 1961, acquiring 160 acres, so one section. They also wanted to build an A-frame cabin, install a T-bar, and have skiing available only an hour and a half from Fowler's home. So I guess at that time, Mount Spokane just wasn't good enough, even though it was more established because they already had a ski team and stuff. He wanted, you know, at this point, it probably would have been like backcountry skiing for him, a little bit more adventurous. So the enthusiasm Jack and Grant had for the project became infectious, and soon most of Sandpoint was supporting their dream. One of the supporters was, back to Mr. Jim Brown, whose company, the Pack River Lumber Company, had possession of 1,200 acres at the bottom of the basin. This land comprised a majority of what would be the ideal land base for the resort.
I love this. You can start to, you know, see the vibrations through the community, creating that what if. So to get the infrastructure in place, Fowler and Grosbeck created a business plan, and they were able to get an SBA loan. Jack remembered that the entire project added up to over $500,000. In the 1960s, that was a lot. It was too big for the two idea guys from Spokane, so they needed help, a lot of help. So they originally set up a nonprofit corporation called Ski Schweitzer. I remember the museum has so much of that early, like, ephemera, which I think is really neat. Like, little, posters and
I'll have to
stickers.
Go find
and
it. Very cool.
Patches. Very fun. And so they sold the shares of the company. Many local citizens invested in the resort. Even a fourth grade class scraped together enough money to buy a share. I love that.
That is very cool. So these two guys from Spokane were, he was a dentist, Fowler's a dentist, Grosbeck's an architect, but they're not. So they're doing pretty well, but they're not wealthy enough to just say, let's start a ski resort, the two of us.
Yeah.
And they're not, like, strictly businessmen.
Right.
So yeah, they've got, yeah,
they're otherwise occupied too with their own careers.
Yeah. Very passion driven. And well, with every large project, it had its opponents. So the previous mayor refused to support their goals, as well as a rival group who had their own dream for the ski area atop Baldy Mountain. So this was to the south of Schweitzer. And in an attempt to settle whose dream would succeed, the community brought in Nelson Bennett, manager of the White Pass ski area. So here comes the expert. So whose research revealed that Schweitzer's weather and terrain were superior, and he ruled it the better mountain.
In his report, he remarked, after looking at the two areas, it appears that Schweitzer Basin would be the better of the two developments. It is protected, fairly accessible, and does have interesting varied ski terrain with an adequate cover of dry snow.
So did that do it? We had Nelson Bennett come in and he decided things?
Well, it was a key factor in it. So construction of Schweitzer began in the summer of 1963. So using their own money raised from the community, and a series of loans, they built a road. Can't even imagine the cost of that, right? Installed a lift and cleared runs and built also a day lodge.
This is where the Browns come back in once again. A subsidiary of the Pack River Lumber Company was the Pack River Roads Department. They built the road into the top of the mountain. The first road was rough. It was a dirt road with never more than a 7% grade and had many switchbacks and often mudded out in the spring.
That's not totally unfamiliar to what we
to drive on any Forest Service road, and that sounds kind of familiar.
Yeah.
Okay. It still happens, but our roads are in much better shape.
They really are
than they were back then.
Paved.
Yes.
So there was no money to pay the Browns, so they were paid in company stock at the time. And we'll come back to that.
That's a big volunteer job.
Uh-huh. Becomes important later, doesn't it? Yeah, okay.
So after the road was in place, the next challenge was to build a lift. Jack Fowler said of it, Chair 1 has an intermediate get-off. This gives the average skier the option of, oh, wait, and we'll come back to this too, because it did not actually have an intermediate get-off at first, but they envisioned it that way. Mm-hmm. This would give the average skier the option of skiing the lower, less arduous slopes, or audacious, I guess. the ride to the top gives the better-than-average skiers a total of 1,689 feet of vertical drop and access to 1,200 skiable acres. As the third feature of the original Schweitzer, Grant Grosbeck, remember our resident architect, designed a day lodge. Its concave roofline was an unmistakable feature of the original village of Schweitzer, and back then, the lodge was the only building there.
Gosh, I love that architectural detail.
It's amazing. I don't know how they built it to support the snow load, yeah. Because when you look at it, the timbers curve up like a cup shape.
Right. Holding
so I'm not sure how that worked.
So the peaks were on like on the outside, like above the outer walls. And it was
a curve.
Into. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that
like the hull
even...
of a boat. Almost.
Okay. Well, and maybe that's why it's not there. I don't know.
I don't know.
But it looked very cool.
Yeah. Okay. Design over function always, right?
Yeah.
So through it all, Jack and Grant pushed forward and opened Schweitzer in December of 1963 with a mile-long double chair lift that could transport 600 people up the hill per hour. One of the most significant memories from Jim Parsons Jr. was about opening day at Schweitzer. He states that there was a nice split of skiers and curiosity seekers. I love that. That's another new word I'm going to use. He remembered the family that bought the first tickets, the Toomies, and Jim and his wife Clarice bought the first season passes. Everyone was on wooden skis, leather boots, and cable bindings. He said it was an exciting day. That first season in 1963, an adult season pass was only $150, which seems kind of a lot for that, right?
It kind of does, yeah.
And an adult lift ticket was only, drum roll.
1963, okay.
$3.50.
For a lift ticket, okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. For an adult.
Oh, man.
And, okay, the season pass being $150, mm-hmm. one lift ticket being $350. Wouldn't it have just made more sense to buy individual lift tickets for the days that you're there than a season pass?
For most people, I would say so. You would have had to ski, like, I think 43 days per season to pay for your pass.
Yeah.
There are people that do that, but that would be a lot than I could do.
Yeah. That's interesting. Okay. Does a lift ticket always mean, just curious, I don't know, does a lift ticket always mean... Here's your ticket. You got a lift ticket for the day, or is it like buy a ticket and you get to go up the chairlift one time?
Oh, that's a good question. I assume
this is just occurring to me right now.
Yeah.
I should have said.
Throw it into the mix.
Yeah. I don't know.
Callers.
Yeah. I mean,
anyone remember?
Yeah. And nowadays it means a lift ticket's a lift ticket for the day. But mm-hmm. I wonder if in 1963 it meant something different.
That's
a good point.
I don't know. Okay.
Well, please correct us out
I'm
there.
I'm sure we're going to get some phone calls about that.
So there were still a few hiccups to work through during the first season. Jim Brown remembered that despite the fancy lift, Sandpoint only had about a dozen expert skiers at the time. And the terrain at the top of the lift was too difficult for most people. Remember how they originally envisioned having a midpoint where you could get off? That didn't happen. They wound up, I think that I was reading something about the guy who came in from Canada to be their like operations manager. Mm-hmm. And he said there was like a shortage of lifts at the time, so they had to go with a model that they didn't want.
Oh, interesting.
And so they got the one that didn't have a halfway get-off point. So the terrain at the top of the lift was really hard for most people in Sandpoint who didn't have a lot of experience skiing. However, shortly thereafter, they added a rope tow for the beginners, and later they added a T-bar. It was too expensive in the early years to add more chairlifts. So they just had the one for a long time. They also, I love this, they also brought in an Austrian ski racing coach and a Swiss ski patrolman. So this is a big deal. But these expert coaches did not know how to teach beginners. I suspect they just didn't have a lot of patience with the beginners, which further added to the mayhem on the mountain because people were going up without any real training. Fowler said, "In retrospect, it seems we had an idea back in 1960 that sort of got out of hand."
So despite these challenges, the ski resort was off to a strong start. The first season, there were 23,000 visitors. They made headlines the following year for staying open on Christmas Day.
Isn't skiing on Christmas morning still, like, traditional for a lot of families on Schweitzer today?
Yes, it is. Thanks to the heavy, consistent snow in the early seasons, and therefore the consistent business, the economic impact of Schweitzer was beginning to be felt. By 1971, and accommodations began to expand. So the Red Cricket was the first permanent lodging available at Schweitzer and was the first condo development approved in the state of Idaho. So that's really interesting. We know some people that have a place up there, which is really fun. So by 1980, early food establishments were expanding, including the Cake and the Outback Inn.
Haven't heard of the Cake before.
No. But there's some good stories from that. Schweitzer partnered with the Sandpoint Chamber of Commerce's Winter Carnival to the locals' delight. And in 1985, Schweitzer even hosted a tourism seminar for Sandpoint businesses.
Around this time, after two decades of successful operations, Schweitzer first began considering serious expansions. In the spring of 1983, the resort area was rezoned from rural to recreational, opening up new development opportunities. But despite its popularity and seeming success, like most small ski resorts in the 1980s, Schweitzer was not turning a profit. At the time, the Brown family still owned 77% of stock certificates and had been funding the losses each year.
Okay, so this is the Brown family has the Pack River Lumber Company and own the majority of owns the majority, but not all of Schweitzer.
Correct.
But yeah, they're basically subsidizing Schweitzer out of the lumber company for most years.
Yeah, so they were asked to build the road for free and were paid in stock. But now that they own most of the stock, they're having to pick up the tab for any lean times as well. So around this time, the famous resorts in Colorado were setting a high new bar as high-class destination resorts. For smaller resorts, or still called, you know, ski hills around the country, this created pressure to keep up or fall behind and fail. Jim Brown, as majority stockholder and chairman of the founding board, decided to take action. He surveyed the almost 600 stockholders who were amenable to the organization going private. The first step was for the Brown family to buy out all of the original stockholders for $15 a share, $5 more than the original $10 they each paid. The second step was to re-envision Schweitzer's business plan.
So in 1985, the Brown family brought in consultants from EchoSign Mountain Resort Masterplan Limited to do a preliminary study. Mr. Brown had one stipulation: the plan must be family-oriented. Mr. Brown knew that winter activity was important for the county and wanted all local young people to grow up with the opportunity to ski.
That's really
that
cool.
That is really neat.
Yeah, I love that that was in the vision way back when.
Working alongside her father was Bobby Huguenin, who served first as managing partner until Mr. Brown passed away in the spring of 1989, then as president. Continuing the work she and her father started, Bobby finally unveiled the ambitious master plan that had been brewing for over 5 years. On January 25th, 1990, she said, This is the most ambitious expansion plan in Schweitzer's history. We had to make the choice whether to remain a weekend resort or expand.
Envisioned as a multi-phased 10-year program, the plan for the newly renamed Schweitzer Mountain Resort was expected to cost $100 million. So remember, the original work cost half of $1 million, and they were like, so much money. Mm-hmm. So the expansion is going to cost $100 million.
Wow.
But generate a $500 million economic impact on the community and create more than 300 jobs. On May 10th, 1990, they broke ground. 1990 to 91 goals included a 61,000 square foot condominium hotel, a detachable quad lift capable of carrying 2,800 people an hour, and a 44,000 square foot day lodge, as well as updated infrastructure, including the installation of night skiing, snowmaking equipment, and major road improvements.
By the year 2000, they hoped to accommodate 10,000 skiers a day, as well as be a global destination for conventions, the arts, and year-round recreation. While she had her eye on the future, Bobby never lost sight of the mountain's past. In the old days, the ski instructors and the ski patrol would do a demonstration run at the end of each day, Bobby recalls. They wore beautiful red jackets and skied down the last run together, creating designs with their bodies, almost like a ski ballet. In anticipation of the show, guests would après-ski at the lodge. Today, all that remains of this is the torchlight parade. Oh, I love that. What an amazing tradition. Another one we need to bring back, right?
Right. And I've seen the torchlight parade, which they do once a year. Mm-hmm. It's very cool, but I didn't realize that they did it every single day.
Yeah, and like, what a great way to finish out the day and feel really celebrated as a ski patrolman. Woman as well.
Unfortunately, the expansion plan and the economy did not ultimately sink. Despite $14 million in loans, the expansion so far had cost $17 million, leaving the Browns with a $3 million deficit that real estate sales were not able to cover. By 1997, the resort went into bankruptcy, and by the end of 1998, Seattle-based company Harbor Properties bought the assets. While no longer running the mountain, the tremendous legacy that started with Jim Brown Jr., continued by Bobby Brown Huikkinen, lives on today. To this day, the Brown family remains great supporters of the community.
So, in the long run, how did Schweitzer impact Sandpoint's economy?
Well, from a storytelling standpoint,
we don't have all the hard data.
Yeah.
We'll go with a quote. So Jim Parsons Jr. mentioned that before Schweitzer, Sandpoint had a pretty dead downtown. In high school, he used to take his dad's car, go down First Avenue, and spin the car around in the middle of the block. Because there wasn't anything to hit. I still try to do that.
First Avenue, right outside the studio.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
He believed Schweitzer made the biggest difference, boosting Sandpoint's economy bigger than anything that had come before. So,
in the long view, it's the longest lasting intentional tourist attraction of that magnitude that Sandpoint has ever had. And it wasn't just about the money. Jim also said, it was a lot of fun. A lot of locals, people you never thought would take up skiing, took up skiing. It was a fun area.
Mm-hmm. And as Gary Peach wrote in 1964, as one rides up the new lift with its bright yellow towers and red chairs, you can't help but be humbled by the vastness of the basin. There is no sound except for the muffled hum of the lift that carried you at the treetop level up the hill. We paused to watch the Canadian Olympic Alpine team. Over the crest of the hill they came, bending, pulling, pushing their way down with startling swiftness. In another second, they flashed out of sight in a long straight swoosh to the bottom of its hill. It's almost like a Merry Christmas, Jingle. Dash away, dash away, dash away all.
I have shivers. Okay. So what have we learned here? We've got enough time to talk a little bit about Schweitzer. You guys skiers?
Yes.
Very
you are?
Poor
yeah.
one.
When we,
uh-huh. Me, not you.
Well, okay,
there's that too.
Heather, you are a skier.
Yeah.
Right?
I think one of my favorite, I came here as a snowboarder, but then turned into a skier, and I'm way
we didn't even talk about snowboarding.
Better skier. But one of the beauties was when one of my first son is younger, I could drop him off at school, and a girlfriend and I would drive up, hit the mountain, ski for a couple hours, come back down, go to work, or pick up our kids. And it was so amazing to be able to have that. And it just became like such a special time for me. And I hope to get back to that. But we're just so lucky to have that so nearby, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not a big thing. You just incorporate it like going to lunch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like one way to do lunch. It. Yeah.
Sure. And okay. Hannah?
I think a lot of people, you know, talk about, well, there's so many different reasons why people say that Schweitzer's special. I think one that is kind of well known is that it has so much terrain. And one thing that I love about that is, you know, I feel ambitious going down Vagabond, which is a delight. But yes. I love that you can, you know, get down to the outback and there will be 300 people there all like getting out of their skis to go have lunch. And then you go up Stella and then start coming back down the mountain and suddenly you're alone. Like there's no one in sight. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, this is really, it's just a winter wonderland. There are so many magical little pockets where you can really listen and be quiet mm-hmm. and try not to fall down too many times.
Yes.
No one will see you when you fall down repeatedly. But yeah, I just love that balance of being able to be in the people in the community up there, but then also find this like serenity and solitude too, all during the same day.
Pretty spiritual.
Yeah.
And the other thing that everyone would tell me that, you know, skied quite often, it during those hard winter months, you know, late January into February, it was the one place where you could find sun.
Yeah.
Which I find true. Amazing.
And above the clouds.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those gray days. The clouds hang kind of low. You can get over them if you climb high enough. Okay. So Schweitzer had been known as a possible place where you could ski going way back. Mm-hmm. It starts in the 60s. These two guys from Spokane basically say, let's get this thing going. It is basically a community effort.
Mm-hmm. Community driven for sure.
Yeah. And I know that, I mean, a lot of, I want to say it's the Chamber of Commerce, but there was, I mean, people more or less, the community was kind of behind it. Said mm-hmm. this is a good thing. We know that they knew at the time that tourism was a big part of the economy. They already had the lake, but they didn't have a big tourist draw in wintertime.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so with the K&K Derby, they had kind of figured out the secret to getting mm-hmm. business in mm-hmm. the summer. But it's hard to sustain over the winter if you don't have any business for 5 months. So it was it fit nicely as a puzzle piece in the Sandpoint mm-hmm. tourist economy.
Yeah. I know I was reading that book. There was a quote from Hazel Hall mm-hmm. saying that wife of Ross Hall, who's an internationally renowned photographer who was kind of based here. She said that before Schweitzer, basically, they'd make their living in the summer and then have to take out loans to make it through the winter, pay them off in the summer again. Mm-hmm. And then Schweitzer arrived and suddenly for anybody whose business was based around tourism or having people come into and out of town, that suddenly things started to make economic sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do. I've heard that from several people, this idea of everyone makes a lot of money in the summer and then everyone, you know, lives on neighborly good credit through the winter and you're just kind of like shuffling the goods around. But I love that the community looked out for each other like that. And But it must have been such a relief to have consistent money getting mm-hmm. infused into the community through those lean times.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody pays attention to, like, I am not a skier, but I always know, I'm always aware of, like, how the snow is up at Schweitzer. Mm-hmm. Or when are they opening? What kind of year are they having, basically? Yeah. You know, the information just kind of, even if it's not broadcast mm-hmm. over airwaves like this, it's just mm-hmm. kind of around town. It's yeah. known how things are going up there.
It's a facet of who we are. It's one of those jewels that makes Sandpoint so unique and special. And I hope they always carry that name forward, too, because that's another historical aspect that makes them unique and special mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it went from, but it was a community, it was a nonprofit, owned it originally, mm-hmm. driven by the local community and then the founders from Spokane, and big part of it being driven by the Brown family. Mm-hmm. Browns took it private in the 80s, mm-hmm. tried and started on the big expansion to kind of how we know it today, taking it from as Bobby Brown Huguenin said, a weekend resort to something more. I can't remember what exactly she said.
And not to forget that crazy economic downturn that happened in the 80s.
Yeah.
Where everybody was trying to, you know, figure out how do we survive, you know, mm-hmm. during this time mm-hmm. and stay, yeah. you know.
And I don't know, it's a little more recent mm-hmm. for our museum archives, but I imagine it was tough for Schweitzer during the 2008 economic downturn oh, yeah. as well, mm-hmm. Which I think Bobby kind of set them up on a good track just by putting effort into planning for the future. Mm-hmm. She kind of set that, she established that practice of projecting the next 10, 20, 50 years of mm-hmm. business. And I know with the, you know, more recent owners, that's become really standard mm-hmm. practice to be constantly doing those strategic plans and thinking yeah. about how do we get through any economic downturns or a bad snow year.
That yes, kind of thing. Definitely. I can't imagine the costs of trying to run that ski mountain.
Yeah. And I think one of the Jack Fowler quotes said something about when they were first trying to put their business plan together, they had some advisor from another resort tell them, or maybe this was Bobby. I think this was Bobby, actually. She had a mentor from Vail, I think, who told her, you're going to make money 30 days out of the year, but you have to be open for over 100. So you have to make those 30 days count. Mm.
Oh, wow. That I can't even imagine.
Yeah. It was the late 90s. It transferred from private ownership by the Browns to Harbor Properties in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And then it was Harbor that sold it in just the last 5 years to Altera. Is that right? Or did
I should know this. I think there, well.
Another reason the phone's going to start ringing here.
I think there's
minute.
Been, you we know, just a little bit more 60s. Nuance. Yeah, there is sort of a cutoff of where our archives no longer exist. We would have to look in the newspapers to learn the details of the more recent transitions. Mm. But
okay.
So it's been a big part of our economy for the last, what has it been now? 60 years, 61 years this year.
Was there, other than the folks who wanted to make a ski resort of their own at Baldy, mm-hmm. instead of doing it at Schweitzer, was there much pushback in the community? Were there people in the community who said, we don't want to, you know, we don't want this to happen. We don't want to be a part of this, and we would rather not see Schweitzer exist. Was there any kind of, I mean, were there opponents to it, or was it pretty much?
Heather mentioned a mm-hmm. few. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of details about it, but I am curious. You said that the mayor mm-hmm. was against
That's
it.
That's what we were reading.
But Schweitzer research. Has never mm-hmm. been a part of Sandpoint city limits, correct?
Yes.
So I guess he could have been a voice, but he wouldn't have really had any power to say whoever that was at the time. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't remember.
But
yeah, I think, you know, city government, you always have to be really mindful when you're using community funding. And most importantly, you want to make sure that you're focusing on your critical infrastructure needs, you know, making sure your toilets are flushing and you have fresh water. And and then, you know, it's always wonderful to go beyond that. But that's where you do see a lot of community building and community support to for, you know, parks and, you know, recreational areas and so forth.
Yeah. So, yeah, we don't know exactly what else was going on in town in 1960, 61, but there were likely just bigger priorities from the city's perspective, you know, in terms of some of that infrastructure to worry about.
Well, and it's, I guess, the in summation, the this the Fowler quote is in here. We had an idea that just got out of hand, right?
I love it.
I love that he kind of just wanted his own little private.
Yeah, close to his house.
Yeah, like I just want to drive an hour.
That's how it all starts.
Yeah. He wanted to go skiing and he didn't want to have to drive all the way to Montana.
Yeah.
He said, this would work. Let's try here.
Yeah. Okay. And then, you know, you get more and more people on board and it keeps growing. And, you know, I hear feedback from, you know, the community, like when another large corporation takes on something you don't know what changes are going to be implemented. Like, will it still feel like the community mountain? On the other hand, I'm glad we still have it open and running, you know, because there's that flip side. If you don't have the growth and the change to, and the money behind it, and that's typically a pretty small pot to the millions or billions to keep a ski resort running. So I try to remember that as changes come upon us.
Yeah. Yeah.
We still have it open and and there's still days when you can go up there and be alone.
Yeah. And I do want to give a little plug because most of the stories we've shared today have been from some of the people that we would consider either the founders or kind of leaders of Schweitzer over the decades. But I know there are thousands of people out there who have their own individual memories of skiing at Schweitzer, working at Schweitzer, being a part of all kinds of aspects of its existence, history, operations, just people who've loved that ski hill and come back every year to ski it. So if you have a story that you would like to share about Schweitzer, we do have what we call an oral history program at the museum. We do recordings of different people's stories and memories. So always you're welcome to reach out. We'd love to schedule something with you or write it up, type it up, send it to us, and we'd be happy to add that to our archives. The more voices we have, the richer of a story we can tell.
And it's every story, every moment is important. And I think sometimes we forget. My dad just wrote this great memoir of his formative years, and I'm certainly going to make sure that he donates that to his local historical society, because that's really the driver to be able to preserve and share. I mean, everybody's indelible mark and journey is super important.
Absolutely.
Let's pause here for just a moment. We're going to take a little musical break, come back and talk about what we've got planned for, next year already. This is the last Community Character Hour of 2024. Next time we talk, it'll be 25. We'll be right back after this. I think the one to play, considering our current weather forecast, which calls for calls for rather gray weather to take us over Christmas, I think we're going to play something by Dean Martin. We'll be back in a couple minutes with more from the Community Character Hour right after this.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go,
Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. Dino, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. That's speaking strictly for myself. That's what I'm hoping for. It would be nice to have a little snow down here. They're getting plenty up at those higher elevations, but it's been a little bit mild, a little gray this winter. Yeah, so far we could use a little white, I think, on the ground. You're listening to the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack Peterson here with Heather Upton and Hannah Combs, and we're talking a little bit about what's coming up next in January 2025 and the whole of 2025. We kind of had a theme for 2024. Mm-hmm. It turned out. We fell into a theme.
Well, history dictated that, right?
Yeah. We did a lot of looking kind of at tourism and how people got here, what drew people here in the modern times, mm-hmm. anyway, more or less modern times. Now we're going back further, and we're kind mm-hmm. of going to start looking at geological happenings and how things that happened in ancient history and even pre-human history have continued to affect us to this day. And how do we start things off in January?
Well,
Hannah,
don't get me started. Yeah. It'll be another hour.
Okay.
So we're mm-hmm. going to start things off with discussing the Ice Age floods.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know about it, we're going to save it till January to talk about it. Very exciting, cataclysmic events mm-hmm. that literally formed the land that we live today. So
yeah, the lake, the basin, all of these jewels that people mm-hmm. that drew people here.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It's all thanks to floods in the Ice Age.
Yes. Okay, so that's how we're going to kick things off in January, and mm-hmm. then kind of, ideas for what else we're going to talk about in 2025. Other things you want to make sure we get to?
Just natural resources that are so unique to Sandpoint, and mm-hmm. and kind of from that, what happened, right? What mm-hmm. local economy was spurred from that? How did that change, like, the social and economic fabric that we see today?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to do a lot more research this year. It'll be great.
Dan okay. Evans and Will Valentine. Aww. Well, yes. We so appreciate you all for mm-hmm. supporting all of our research mm-hmm. and history and all of the other incredible volunteers that help us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I'm excited that we're going that far back. Before you had newspapers telling us what was happening around town, it's harder to find information, but luckily, thanks to local scholars, those stories have been documented, many of them, and we're excited to dig into some of those that happened so long ago you may not have heard of them before.
Dig in, pun intended. I love it.
Well, thank you both for a very fun year here on the airwaves. This has been... Yeah, a real treat,
such
the Community
delight.
Character Hour. We started, I think, in January, and so we have 12 episodes down. We're starting year two.
It's legit. January.
It's a real thing.
With that, it's time for Bird Note. Heather, Hannah, thank you so much for a fun show, a fun year.
Thanks for having
Jack.
Us.
Merry Christmas.
Merry mm-hmm. Christmas, indeed. Here we go. Time for Bird Note. You're listening to 88.5 KRFY, Ponderay.